I've heard a lot of people say that too, and all, but
which I wouldn't know. I mean, I don't have that much experience, but that's what she told me when we were talking about behavior and training, and I was trying to get her, you know, with me on, you know, I was trying to develop some bird behavior training DVDs, and I have some bird behavior training experience, but it's not force-free training, and it's old school, and, you know, I came against a lot of conflict with people in the force-free training world with my technique, so, you know, I just abandoned it because it was just too much trouble, and it wasn't, you know, showing any kind of potential profit. And it's what I've been doing over 30 years, trying to help people with their birds. But in those conversations with Yvonne, you know, I was kind of trying to, you know, see if there was some territory out there that I could, you know, kind of navigate in my bird behavior training venture that would work and would help people, and that's what she told me. You know, she said flat out, she said the wildcats are the easiest to tame, and it takes less time, and these domestic birds, and maybe buddy, is because of this also that Yvonne shared with me, and some ornithologists that she's involved with. She said that it might be because of the absence for such a long period of time of wildcat birds in the breeding cycles of domestic breeders here in the U.S. that we have all this behavior problem. The DNA has been thinned out. They're being overbred, and, you know, and there's no original species in the breeding cycle. So it's, I mean, we've got, I've seen, you know, for my 30 years, lots and lots of behavior problems and plucking and nervous disorders. And you don't see this with wildcat birds. And you go get a bunch of wildcat birds. I've had wildcat birds in my possession.
They don't behave
like domestic birds, and they don't have the health issues or, you know, plucking and nervous disorders and that kind of thing.
Wait. I can get you documentation. First of all, let's dispel that that birds in the wild don't pluck. There's not a problem with feather destruction, because it is. It's been documented. I got people who've been to Brazil and studied the hyacinths in the wild and all, and there are pictures of them with feather destruction. Now, really, what I think in the wild...
Yeah, but that's because they're nesting. That's a nesting practice because they pull their feathers out to make a nest.
But they don't
pluck themselves bald, do they?
Yes, they do pluck themselves. And obviously, they got to be able to survive, to fly to survive. I personally, and there's no research on this, I believe that when there's problems with feather plucking, as we see it, what happens to that bird in a while? It doesn't reproduce. It dies. So if you got a bird that plucks herself bald and chews its wingtips off and all in a while, it's not going to survive. And there are many reasons for feather plucking, but the point about wildcats being used is it makes no difference. Wildcats could be the answer to all of our avian problems. It makes no difference. We can't import wildcats. Most species, we can't import them. Some we may be able to, but it doesn't make any difference. Now, I do think that breeders and aviculturists all need to do a better job of picking some of the birds they use for breed stock. They need to put birds back, need to let them be parent raised. I got several birds that were parent raised. I got some that are third and fourth generation. Their parents were parent raised. And their parents were parent raised, and they came from wild calls. And some of them are listed in the stud books like this. and there's theory that these make better breeders, and some of their babies are more established and, you know, don't have these problems. And, you know, but feather plucking is not exclusive to domestic birds. It happens in the wild. And, you know, Casimir Chalky's got information on it.
I understand feather plucking is also related to nutritional issues, which could arise in the wild. And I'm not challenging you, buddy. I'm not challenging you. I love Kashmir. How do you say her last name? I really enjoy her dissertations online. She's quite the expert.
Chalky.
Chalky.
Chalky. There are avian vets, and some of them you might have need to have on interviews sometime. There are a lot of them that are saying that most of this feather plucking, they're finding out there's other problems. And you just mentioned nutrition. That can be one. Other problems, you know, there can be ailments and all.
Toxins in their food. Because they're eating.
There can be problems. In other words, you know, if you're sick, you got a headache or a backache or a stomachache. The birds, they got something wrong with them. They're sick, and it makes them feathers. But one of the first things that a good avian vet looked at when they got a bird come in, and the bird's plucked, and the plucking, maybe they're plucked on one side, not the other.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
because of a liver
it's a
disease
problem.
Or some other
right. Avian board certified vets, true avian vets, are starting to learn that feather destruction, a lot of it is other problems. Some of it is behavioral, and I'm a big proponent of parent raising birds, leaving birds with the parents as long as you can, and all. I think, and there are more and more breeders doing that. Example, the breeder that I got a lot of my free flyers from, when I met her, she was incubating 5 years ago. She was incubating a lot of eggs. She's like, you know, I'm going to get this egg, and I'm not going to take any chance to lose it. So she incubated birds that would sit on eggs. She was pulling the babies at just a few days old. Now she's leaving those babies in there longer. She's a minimum of 3 weeks since parents feed them. The only time she pulls a bird is when she thinks his life's in jeopardy and all. And some birds, she leaves them longer. Sometimes when I get a bird from her, I'll say, hey, leave it in there a little bit longer. But it's
parent raised birds.
We think this is help. Yep. And I got several birds that are parent raised birds. I got babies in the nest now that their parents are raising them. Everybody's like, why don't you pull that baby? Why don't you pull that baby? I said, I'm taking a chance. I want that bird to be parent raised.
Okay, what is it about parent raised birds that helps the baby more?
It sees, it learns to be a bird. It sees the things the parents do. I've had people that said, well, they leave some birds in there for a year or two or three and all, especially when it's a breeder that's setting them back for breeding stock. The birds see the behavior. They see the parents feeding each other. They see the parents feeding the clutch. And there are some people that will have babies that are several months old, a year old, and they'll have babies in the nest. And these are parent-raised birds that are being set back. They'll see their parents feeding each other, and, you know, they'll see the female in the box and the male feeding her, and then they'll see the female feeding the babies, and then maybe later on the male will be feeding the babies. All they see this. It even goes further. You know, there's some breeders put birds together and they just can't get them to reproduce. What's that?
They're learning to be birds. And I hate to interrupt you because you are so full of great information. But I was just talking to Tony Silva. I think it was last night he mentioned that. He probably mentioned it a few times. It's better to let the parents raise the birds, and parent raised birds learn to be birds. He mentioned that a few times, that not only in the, you know, in the raising of a baby bird, but Tony also emphasized that in the keeping of birds, that we should try to help the bird live more like a bird than a pet.
Yep. Yes. And it goes even further. Some people that are working with the parent-raised birds even believe when these birds start getting, you know, where they fledged with their parents and they've come out of that nest box, they're flown and all, they start picking up some of the adult habits. We're finding out that parent-raised birds and birds that are fully flighted and all make better breeders. And part of it is we believe that you got a young bird that's a year or two old in it, in there with his parents or in a big flight. They can see them. They get to see the other birds interact. It's so far as to see them copulate. They see that and they learn these habits and it helps them. Now, what agriculturists are learning that they've done wrong? What do? They take the bird that bites, screams, and plucks, and breeds it to the bird that bites, screams, and plucks. And a lot of people are guilty of that. I've had people, pet owners, call me up and said, do you know a breeder that will take a cockatoo? Well, I don't have cockatoos. I don't study cockatoos or whatever. I'm like, well, why do you want to get rid of your cockatoos? Well, it's 10 years old now, and it's hard to handle. And they're insistent they want that bird to be put in somebody's breeding program. So they're taking this bird that was a bad pet, and they won't it be put in a breeding situation, and the bird might be truly be happier and all. But what does he do? The person that gets it, they could get another bird that's a good chance came from a similar situation. It was a bad pet. It screamed. It fucked. It bit. It never learned to fledge. It was put in a cage that was too small, and they breed the two together. And do you think that you get somebody that wins the Kentucky Derby? Do you think that they bought a bargain basement horse and bred it to a bargain basement horse, some horse that somebody didn't want, it couldn't run well and all?
I have a lot to say about that.
Yeah.
I was born in Kentucky, and my father owns the largest sorebred horse insurance company on the planet, or one of them.
I have to brag a little bit there, but
yeah. Yeah, but that's relative.
What are they doing? They're breeding the best horse to the best horse. I mean,
right.
When you got it, and that breeding, you got
for
breed.
The strength and agility and the endurance and all the best of what you could get from a horse.
And in agriculture, U.S. agriculturists have done a bad job of this, and it's something that I'm beginning to understand more, and I'm learning a lot of this from really, I call them accomplished and seasoned agriculturists like Tony Silva and others that have worked with these species like this. And I mentioned before that there's some birds that are in the stud books, and there's some birds that their lineage can be traced back and all. And so, you know, we need to work harder to do this. And I think it'll take care of some of the problems. And what I've been saying about parent-raised birds that Tony Silva said, stuff like that, some of that probably fits in with what Yvonne Patterson's been saying. And, you know, we won't have these problems. And, you know, there's some theories, too, about hand-feed babies are making some of these problems. Now, Tony Silva's written some good articles and had them published on that. And he's saying that some of the hand raised babies, depending on how they're hand raised, are just as good as parent raised, and he's kept up with some of this, you know. But
well, if you can feed them as well as a parent, I mean, yeah, and not mean to
well, but
again,
they but don't learn. They don't,
Tony's really
they don't
a guru and had a lot of experience with breeding. And maybe, some people get it so right that they believe, that they could raise a bird as well as a parent. And I think Tony's one of those people.
Well, and he does, and he has. But let me finish. He does it. The raising it as good as a parent is not a matter of getting them the nutrition and all. It's more than that. And some of these birds that Tony said that he's hand fed, and they ended up being just as good of birds and making good breeders. He didn't coddle them. That's where we're messing up.
Hey, what about? This is all such great information, Tony. I really appreciate your time tonight. And something else, when you were talking earlier about aggression, I remember on the last show you talked about breeding triggers, things that trigger breeding responses in birds, and removing nesting areas. And related to breeding triggers.
You need to understand that three factors stimulate breeding. Obviously, light, increased photo period, diet, and the availability of a nest. Darkness induces ovulation in the female, testicular development in the male. So that's a rich diet. So you need to understand these three elements and then apply it accordingly to a bird that may become hormonal. You don't get a super rich diet to a bird in spring that you worry about becoming hormonal, because you will absolutely trigger it into breeding. You don't give a cockatoo, you don't give any parrot a box to sleep in. I've seen people give tents to conures. And they do that in spring. The bird's mind is, oh, geez, this is a nest. So I've got to lay eggs. You want to be able to, if you do that, you introduce a tent at a time of year when they're not breeding, or you do it when they're young. And many conures in the wild sleep in tree cavities. But when you give them something dark that's comfortable, it may well be, hey, this is a nesting cavity.
So they think it's a nest box. And what about covering up birds, like at night, to keep them warm? Is that necessary? And would that also kind of contribute to this breeding trigger? And listening audience, what we're talking about is some behavior issues. The topic tonight is pet bird ownership and what you can do to be more successful owning your bird and picking out the right bird for you. Tony is talked about a lot of things tonight, and we're touching on the breeding triggers that could cause behavior that's hard to deal with. breeding behavior. So if you have things in your home that resemble nesting areas, like cardboard boxes that you let your birds get into, or little tents, or the bird is in darkness more than light, this might trigger breeding behavior, ovulation in the females, and whatever you call it that the males get into when they're breeding, as well as a rich diet. Again, Tony, would covering your birds, would that contribute to this?
Some birds are like humans. I, for example, like to go to bed early, but I wake up very early. So it depends. My kids love to be up very late and they sleep in the morning. So, I think that covering the cage is a good thing at night, because it basically tells the bird, okay, time to rest. When you uncover it in the morning, it's time to wake up. So it's a way of controlling a little bit the bird's activity, and many birds get used to being covered at night. I don't necessarily think that it has to be done because of temperature fluctuations at night. These things can take incredible amounts of cold. You know, after all, a down comforter is full of down feathers. And the birds all develop the appropriate feathering for different seasons. You obviously don't want to put a bird that's been kept in a 70-degree home in 50-degree temperature. And if you do the reverse, it will induce a molt. So you want to always have a stable environment. And for a pet bird, so that it does not become sexually active, you want as stable of an environment as possible. You don't want a photo period change. You don't want to go from a bland, meaning a fairly basic diet that's not full of wet things, to a very wet diet. You know, that's how you trigger many species to breed. You go from a simple diet to a very rich, very wet diet with lots of vegetables and things like that. So you need to have stability. Stability is number one.
Would the diet be probably the strongest trigger for these breeding?
It's not one, it's three. You know, it's the availability of the nesting cavity. Yeah, diet, and then photo period.
I see. So if you had all three just right for what the bird would normally respond to as breeding trigger, then you would probably get breeding behavior. And something Tony said on the last show, listening audience, was interesting, is that if you've got all of this scenario just right, where your bird thinks it's time to breed, and your bird runs under the couch or into the cardboard box you gave them to play in, and it thinks it's going in there to create a nest, and you think it's going in there just to play around, you reach for your bird and it bites you, then I'm your host, Mike Kiger. Over 30 years ago, I worked in a major franchise pet store as a bird salesman, where I learned some basic bird behavior training and grooming. There were birds in the store that could not be sold as they were too vicious or afraid of people. They often bit people that tried to handle them. I still remember thinking that it would have been so great if people could have enjoyed those birds instead of struggling with them. Since then, I've helped some friends and neighbors with their birds along the way in my life. About 7 years ago, some friends that have seen me work with birds encouraged me to develop my bird experience with exotic birds into a business. KC Bird Whisperer International are dedicated to the enjoyment of pet birds and promotion of related products, services, and events. I hope you enjoy KC Bird Whisperer International productions and support our efforts to provide rich, informative media to the avian public and people thinking about getting a bird. Please visit www.birdtalkradio.com again soon and enjoy our internet radio broadcast of Bird Talk Live Online and our podcast on podbean.com. I'm your host, Mike Kiger. Thank you for tuning in today.